If you have your Bibles and want to open them, we'll be spending a little bit of time in a text in 2 Samuel. Originally, when you receive training as a minister or even as a therapist, the grieving model was done out of a book written by Elizabeth Kubler Ross. Dr. Ross was at the time she was Nurse Ross, was a nurse on a terminal ward. And she began to make some observations about the people who would come to her ward and not leave that ward, both the patients themselves and their families. And she kind of created this model that we have often adopted for the grieving process, the denial, the shock, the anger. And as we've worked through using that model, you've heard terms like people are stuck in grieving. Or you've heard terms like complicated grieving. Well, the reason that we end up with terms like that is because we have taken grieving to be a linear process, that you start at point A and you end up over here at point G or F. And grieving is not a linear process. It is not something that you do and have to take these incremental steps in order to get to it. In the last 10 years or maybe even more, the American Academy of Bereavement has come out with what they consider to be a more active model or more accurate model based on some of the work by William Worden. And they talk about the four tasks of grieving. And when you talk about the four tasks of grieving, it'd be like having the four legs under a chair. If I get two or three legs under a chair, depending on which legs I've got, I can sit in that chair. But if something happens to cause me to shift my weight or to get off balance, I get dumped out. That's why you go through a grieving process. You feel like you're pretty stable, you feel like you're pretty good, and then all of a sudden something can be said, something can happen, an anniversary, a special date, anything can trigger a corruption of your balance, and you're in the floor again. And so what we've learned to do is talk about analyzing these four tasks, and when all four of them are in place, you're pretty well balanced, you pretty well have stability. But until you have all four, until they're all four in place, and until they're all four permanently in place, you can reach some moments of instability. And the first thing to understand is instability is kind of normal. It's okay to have periods of time and things that trigger you and things that cause you to fall over, things that cause you to be out of balance. Pain is proof of life. Pain is proof of validity. You get a little ninth grade girl and she's broken up with some ne'er-do-well boy and she hurts. Well, the reason it hurts is because she really loved that rascal. She really meant what she said. And him being a ninth grade boy, he doesn't understand the word love. She kissed him goodnight because of the way she felt about him. He kissed her goodnight because of the way it made him feel. And he wasn't really involved in that as much as she was. But when it hurts her when they break up, it's because what she said and what she expressed were emotionally valid and emotionally honest. So when something happens that causes us pain, it's not a sign of weakness. It's a sign of validity. The reason Mike's loss is so impactful upon you is because you really, really loved him and he really, really loved you. And that's not a sign of weakness if it still hurts. It's not a sign of lack of faith. It doesn't have anything to do with your spirituality if it continues to hurt for some time. But there's a natural process where the hurting gets replaced by other things. If you have that text, go ahead and look at 2 Samuel. David has sinned with Bathsheba, the wife of Uriah. A child has been formed because of this union. And I'm not sure that it's a punishment from God as much as God recognizing that this child's going to have a right to the throne. And a child that's the product of an adulterous relationship is going to compromise everything that Israel is supposed to be about. So God's not going to permit this child to live. And so we find 2 Samuel chapter 12, the latter part of verse 15. And the Lord struck the child that Uriah's wife bore David, and it became ill. Therefore David pleaded with God for the child. And David fasted and went in and lay all night on the ground. Now the elders of his house arose and went to him to raise him up from the ground, and he would not, nor would he eat food with them. And then on the seventh day, it came to pass that the child died. And the servants of David were afraid to tell him that the child was dead. For they said, "Indeed, while the child was alive, we spoke to him, and he would not heed our voice. How can we tell him that the child is dead? He may do some harm." You've got the warrior king of Israel who lives in a palace, sleeping on the floor. He's refusing to eat, and he's lying on the ground, begging for this child to survive. His counselors, his wise advisors, tell him how he ought to act. "You shouldn't respond this way to this." And David says, "You know, I'll do this my way." And so he's there. Well, 7 days later, this baby dies. And the elders go, "You know what? If he acted this way while that child was sick, I'm not going to be the one to tell him that it's dead. He may do some harm." Now, I think you need to remember that when people bring David bad news, he typically kills them. And they're not necessarily worried about what David may do to himself. He's worried about, "I don't want to be the guy to deliver that note." And so they're worried about what's going to go on and what David's reaction is going to be to this. Verse 19, when David saw that his servants were whispering, David perceived that the child was dead. And therefore David said to his servants, "Is the child dead?" And they said, "He is dead." And David arose from the ground, washed, anointed himself, and changed his clothes. And he went into the house of the Lord and worshipped, and he went to his own house. He requested that they set food before him, and he ate. And his servant said to him, "What is this that you have done? You fasted and wept while the child was alive, but when the child died, you arose and ate food?" And he said, "While the child was alive, I fasted and wept, for I said, 'Who can tell whether or not the Lord will be gracious that the child may live? But now that he is dead, why should I fast? Can I bring him back again? I shall go to him. He shall not return to me.'" 2,500 to 3,000 years before William Warden ever talked about the fourth task of grieving, the king of Israel went through the process. I don't know that any of us can relate to a man like David. Very seldom does David feel like life is not within his control. If David wants something, he goes and takes it. If David doesn't like something, he goes and eliminates it. David's never seen, except maybe one or two occasions, to even have an insecurity in his entire life. But here you have this super powerful, absolute man of faith who, as a direct result of some of his sin, has put him in a place where he is powerless. And while he's powerless with this child's life, he's lying on the floor and he's refusing to eat and he won't have any contact, and his advisors and his counselors tell him, "You don't need to act this way," and he ignores them. He says, "I'm going to handle it the way I handle it." And when the child dies, they're nervous, they're scared, and they're whispering in the corners, and David just says, "Is this child dead?" And they say he's dead. He changes his clothes. He gets off the floor. He washes himself. He goes first and worships his God. Then he goes to his own house and he says, "Bring me some food." And the servants are just, they're confused. They said, "How in the world can you act like you did while the child was alive and then act this way while the child is dead?" And David's famous statement is, "I thought maybe while the child was alive, there was a chance that God would let him live. But now that he's dead, I understand that he will not come to me. But I will go to him." Basically, David understands the four tasks of grieving. Task number one, we must accept the reality. There is a part of us that is strong in denial. The human error is the assumption of permanence. What is will not always be. And we've got to understand that life's about changing. We are not meant to be permanent residents on this planet. The human body does not improve with age. It is the destiny of all of us to die. And so in this case, David, instead of being in denial, I can't believe the Lord didn't grant my prayer. I can't believe the Lord didn't listen to me. I can't believe this has happened. I can't believe we're going through this. David makes peace with the fact that this is what is. And he accepted the reality. Some of us today are still in that place where we're not accepted for what is. It will be a different matter of time for all of us. Grieving is a function of time. And so some of us will arrive at the conclusion sooner than others. Some of us will arrive at the conclusion later than others. And the unreality of this event that has taken place in your lives, especially the rapidness of it and the unexpectedness of it and the trauma of it, maybe years and years and years. But that's going to be one of those things you struggle with, is that you, number one, accept the reality. Number two is you must express and experience all the emotions. Somewhere along the line, we got this idea that it was unspiritual or it was somehow weak in our Christianity to let our emotions be what they are. God gave us our emotions. Everything that you have the ability to express and feel emotionally came from the factory. God installed the software package in you, and if you use your emotions properly, they lead to balance and harmony. If your emotions aren't processed properly, they don't lead to balance, they don't lead to harmony, and if you use your emotions improperly, they lead to destruction or dysfunction. For instance, notice the example of guilt. Godly sorrow produces repentance that leads to salvation that's not to be regretted. Most of us think guilt is a bad thing. Guilt's not a bad thing. If I feel guilt and feel guilt properly, I'll change the way I'm behaving. I'll make a positive improvement and then it leaves me no regrets. Godly sorrow, guilt, works repentance that leads to salvation that's not to be regretted. If I process my guilt appropriately, it brings back about a positive change in my life. But so many times we don't want to go through that process, and you use the guilt to insulate or to isolate. Take the example when Jesus does the Lord's Supper. The night that Jesus is arrested, betrayed and arrested, one out of the 12 apostles admitted knowing him. Which was it? Judas. The only guy out of all 12 to say, hey, I know where he is, I know where he hangs out, I'm such good friends with him, I'll kiss him when we see him. And yet what happens to Judas when he realizes that he's betrayed the Lord? Matthew 27, and Judas, seeing that he was condemned, took the money back to the chief priest and then went out and hanged himself. Peter denies him three times, yet he goes out and weeps bitterly and then repents. Have the conversation between Judas and Peter. I can't believe you told those guys where Jesus was. I can't believe you told those guys you knew him. I can't believe you told those guys you didn't three times. And yet the one who admitted knowing Jesus self-destructs. The one who denied him three times repents and becomes a very effective gospel preacher. The function of guilt. Guilt's not a bad thing. It's how you use that guilt that depends on whether or not it destroys you or not. Be angry and do not sin. Do not let the sun go down upon your wrath. Nothing wrong with anger. It determines on whether your anger controls you or whether you control the anger. Emotions are not bad, and yet somehow we've taught that you can't have emotions. You take the example of David and Jonathan. David and Jonathan are friends. David will write and say, Jonathan's love for me was dearer to me than the love of the women. And yet when David and Jonathan have to make a departure, and Jonathan is loyal to his father and has to follow him into his last battle, and David goes on and goes back into hiding, when those two guys depart, they embrace each other, they kiss each other, they weep, and the Bible says, and David wept the most. Call David the king of Israel a sissy. I can't believe you effeminate guy would weep like David. Will pull your head off, put it on his hand, use it as a puppet and apologize to himself. I'm sorry, Mr. David, and hand your head back to you. There's nothing effeminate about David. And yet David produces real emotion when he's in trouble. Read the Psalms where David pours his heart out to God about his anger, about his fear. The problem with experiencing and expressing our emotions is somehow we think that if we're too emotional, we're not very spiritual. And there's no disconnect between spirituality and emotionality. And in fact, if you and just look at this, do you understand the difference between a GPS and a thermometer? This means yes. This means no, okay? A thermometer gives you information about the system. It's warm, it's cold. A GPS gives you directions. Does your emotions function like a GPS or like a thermometer? Teenagers use their emotions like a GPS. I feel angry, I'll go down Anger Street. I feel embarrassed, I'll back up down Withdrawal Street. I feel threatened, I'll go down Confrontation Avenue. They use their emotions as a sense of directions, and really that's not the way your emotions are designed. They're simply designed for information. Hey, something's hot in this system, I need to do something to cool it down. Something's cool in this system, I need to do something to warm it up. And so when we understand that our emotions don't give us direction, they just give us information. But when we use our emotions as a sense of directions, then we think because we're angry, we have to act angry. We think we're sad, we have to withdraw. And our emotions do not dictate how we behave. They just simply give us information. So when we experience and express all the emotions that come with grief. Now, there's a range of emotions that are going to come with grief. You may be mad. You can be mad at someone for dying. You can be mad at God for letting them die. If you're mad at God, tell God, Father, I don't understand this. I'm angry. I don't want to be blasphemous, but God's a big guy. People have been mad at him before. Okay? As long as you don't stop talking to him, it will process well. You may feel guilty. I didn't do some things I should have done. I did some things I shouldn't have done. And we take this and we kind of blow it out of proportion. The interesting thing about death and emotions is it tends to skew the way we see them. Read sometime the poem David writes about Saul after Saul gets killed in battle. Saul is a maniacal, murderous, egomaniac. And on two different occasions, he tries to murder David. And on two different occasions, he lies to David about what his intentions are and even lies to his son. Yet after Saul's death, David writes this beautiful poem about how Saul was as swift as eagle and noble as lions. Death sometimes skews the way we treated people, and we either exacerbate how much we did or how little we did, and then we feel bad about it. You've got to express and experience all those emotions, and you've got to express them and experience them with reality so that I don't over-glorify something and I don't under-glorify something. The refusal to use your emotions is going to be a refusal to allow yourself to move forward and connect with the people who are around you. It will be very, very tempting not to invest emotionally into a new minister because of how bad it hurt that we lost this minister. And if you come in with a hesitant investment, that guy can't be successful and your congregation can't be successful. People that you connect to will damage you when they leave, whether they move to a new town or whether they pass away. That's part of being real. And I'd rather be real and have those feelings and never have those feelings but not be real. So accept the reality. Number two, express and experience all the emotions, even the ones you think you shouldn't have. You got to express them some way. In expressing those emotions and experiencing those emotions, if there's some unfinished business, take care of the unfinished business. Rituals are very strong things. That's why we have funerals. They give us a finality. They give us a closure. But if there's some things that are not closed, if there's some things that are undone, do something to close them. I had a lady visiting my practice. Her son was in Texas, and she was knitting him an Afghan, and a tragedy occurred, and the young man lost his life, and she was not going to work. She was not thriving, and we were going through the grief process and talking about things. I wouldn't make any progress with this lady. And I finally said, "What's at your house that's undone?" She says, "I was knitting him an afghan, and he died before I could give it to him." I said, "Finish the afghan, take it to Texas." She finished it, went and draped it over the tombstone, and she's fine. But every time she went home, there was the thing I never did for my son. There was a thing I never completed for my son. If there's something that you needed to tell Mike, tell him. In a letter, in a poem, write it on your iPhone, send it away, put it on a balloon, float it down the river. Take care of unfinished business. If there's something you wished you had done with him or for him, do it for someone else in his name. But do not let those emotions sit unresolved. Take care of the unfinished business. Number three, adjust to the new norm. You accept the reality, what is. You express and experience all the emotions. And then number three, you've got to adjust to the new norm. Defining the new norm, David says, hey, the baby was sick, he might have got better, but now the baby's not. So how am I going to behave now that he's not? And David structured his life not on what could have been, but David began to structure his life on what was. And so many times we have difficulty adjusting to the new norm. And the new norm is the definition, basically, of where we are with what we've got. Now, several years ago, I got invited by the city of Huntsville. I was taking kids to a rock quarry that the city of Huntsville owns and doing some outward bound type stuff, doing some lessons with rappelling. And they contacted me and said, hey, we'd like you to think about taking inner city kids out here and doing some rappelling and teaching those lessons with them. I'm very uncomfortable about taking kids I don't know out on a rock site. Nobody writes newspaper articles about the 10 kids you bring back. It's that one kid you leave out there gets in the paper every single time. And so I decided not to get in the paper. And so I said, if you'll build an indoor climbing facility, if you'll let me have access to an indoor wall, I'll donate some time to it. So they built a little indoor wall at a community center. And so I've been donating time doing some rock climbing and stuff. Well, it was an after-school program. A bunch of seventh graders were coming. And they sent a little guy to my class who only had one arm. And I don't know who was thinking when they let this kid sign up for my rock climbing class. So I've got this little guy with one arm, and we rearranged some of the artificial climbing holes so that it was more like a ladder for him to be able to climb. But one of the things we do in the class is we teach a skill called belaying. That's an old sailing term. It's spelled B-E-L-A-Y. And all amateur climbers do when they climb around here is a thing called top roping. If you could picture a rope thrown over one of your rafters and doubled, and then I attach one end to Scott. As Scott starts to climb, I pull the rope that he's attached to through a break on my harness and am taking up the slack. That's called top roping. The closer he gets to the top, the shorter the rope gets. And that way, if he falls, he just swings in place. You don't incur any dynamic forces or anything. And so we teach the kids how to belay. Then we make the kids belay each other. And then on the fourth class, we make their parents come in, and they have to belay one of their parents up this wall. It's a very interesting learning experience. A young man will stand there and scream at his dad. Why were you screaming at your dad? Well, he was off the ground, and there was a foothold, and he wouldn't put his foot on it, and I was afraid I was going to drop him, and he wouldn't listen to me. So that's okay. So you're responsible for your dad's safety for 15 seconds, and you lose your mind. Your dad's had that feeling ever since you took your first breath. So if he gets a little psychotic when you play T-ball, back off, all right? So it turns into a good learning experience. It gives them their first shot. And so it's a big deal to learn to belay. So, man, I'm sitting here, got ropes hanging everywhere, working with kids, pulling and tugging, and there's this little tug on the back of my harness. Mr. Lonnie, I need to learn to belay. I look over, and it's Chris, the one-arm kid. And I'm stupid on Thursdays, so I said, well, Chris, normally people use two hands to belay. And Chris said, well, normally I just have one. African-American kid, seventh grade, looked me dead in the eye. Said, don't tell me what people with two hands can do. Tell me what I can do with the one hand I've got. Wow. Outside of this book, one of the most significant things ever been said to me in my life. Don't tell me what people with two hands can do. What can I do with the one hand I've got? I know what you did when Mike was here. What can you do now? Who can you love? Who can you invest in? Who can you minister to? Who can you allow to minister for you? Sometimes churches are looking for the guy that they need, and really you should be looking for the guy who needs you as well. Get a guy who you can grow. Get a guy who you can mature. Get a guy who you can teach from your experiences, good and bad, with Mike. But instead of looking at what was, look at what you can do with what you've got. I don't have a basketball goal at my house. I have a judo mat. What can I do with what I've got? And you decide what you as a fellowship, what you as a church, what you as a family can do with your new norm. Not what was, but what is. And how can you be a blessing to each other and to somebody else that comes in? So you accept the reality. You express and experience all the emotions. You adjust to the new norm. And then the fourth task is you reinvest the energy you used for grieving into something new. At some point, you've got to take the love that you had for Mike and give it to somebody who can use it, give it to somebody who can need it. You've got to take your strength as a congregation and the things that Mike taught you and the things that you learned from Mike and the things that you became because of your involvement with Mike and use it in the future. The real sign of recovery is when you quit looking in the past and start looking at the future. I teach on a ropes course. You may or may not be familiar with those. But a lot of the things that we do there involve transitional elements. And you'll start at a place where you're real safe, like standing on a tree, and we'll make you walk across a steel cable to another tree. When you leave this place where you're holding onto a tree, and trees are very stable, by the way, you hold onto this tree and you take a step away from that tree. About the time that cable starts to move underneath you and we build them loose for that purpose, and you start feeling like Elvis, most people head back to the tree they came from. And they get out a little further and those legs start to shake and they go back. When you get out so far that you quit looking at where you came from and start trying to get to that tree, they're going to make it across the cable. Your congregation's on a cable. You've been stable. You're going to be stable. Right now, you're wiggly. Well, if you keep running back to this tree, you'll live with this tree. You've got to reinvest into the new future. You've got to reinvest into something else. You've got to take the energy that you use in grieving and reinvest that energy into something new. David said, I prayed that this child would live. Now that this child is not alive, that's the new norm. What's my new future? He can't come to me. I will go to him. And so David's mission became, I'm going to make it to that child. I'm going to go there. Now let's understand some things about investing into the future. It doesn't mean you forget anybody. It doesn't mean they didn't matter. It doesn't mean it was inconsequential. It just simply means that you take the foundation that they built on and you use it to connect to another foundation and build on it with somebody else. And just one of those things that you hear that's not original with you, but it impacts you. Did you know that the sun is just as bright at midnight as it is at noon? The sun doesn't turn off. It's there all the time. The sun is just as hot in February as it is in July. It has nothing to do with the sun's power. It has everything to do with our location as it relates to our position near the sun. Mike, just as alive as he ever was, just as bright, just as warm. We're just not close enough to feel it. We're just not in the right location to see it. So it's not like Mike doesn't exist. He's real. Just as bright, just as warm. So we don't really have to talk about losing Mike. We may talk about having not as much access to Mike. He's not coming back to you guys. Well, you got to decide whether or not you're going to go to him. You got to decide what your future is. You got to decide what you're going to do. Four tasks of grieving: accept the reality, express and experience all the emotions, adjust to the new norm, and then make a reinvestment into the future. And just a word about that future. Turn in your Bibles, if you will, to 1 Corinthians. Paul lived in Corinth 2.5, maybe 3 years. Made tents with Aquila and Priscilla. Lived there in town. Debated in the Jewish synagogues all the time, and then would go over and have church with the brethren in Corinth. We don't get a lot of traffic on what Paul did while he was at Corinth. But for all practical purposes, Paul was their local minister. And at some point, Paul left Corinth. And Timothy was going to come. How'd you like to be the guy following Paul? A double PhD in Old Testament studies. Fluent in Hebrew, Greek, Aramaic, Roman citizen, could do miracles. Had been translated into the presence of the Lord and been given a vision of heaven. And then his kid Timothy moved to town, who's so nervous he has to drink wine to settle his stomach. And that new preacher drinking wine. Well, he's got a prescription from Paul. Okay, we'll give him a pass. Wow. So I'm the new Timothy going to come? No, thank you. How do you think they, this is the church at Corinth. We'd like you to think about coming, you know, Brother Paul. Negative. You know, call Barnabas, you know. I mean, just leave me. Listen what Paul says, and we read it in passing. 2 Corinthians chapter 16, verse 10. And, I'll wait. Verse 10, 1 Corinthians 16. And if Timothy comes. Okay, Paul understands he may not. Okay, if Timothy comes, see that he may be with you without fear, for he does the work of the Lord as I also do. Now look, Timothy's not me. He can't speak Hebrew. He doesn't have my background. He wasn't raised as a Pharisee. He's not a Roman citizen. In fact, both his parents aren't even Christians. Both his parents aren't even Jewish. But if he comes, don't compare him with me unless you understand that he ministers to the Lord just like I do. Timothy's not Paul, but Timothy's a minister. And that's all you really need at Corinth, is a minister. Now, he'll do things differently than Paul did. He's probably nicer than Paul, if you just want to know the truth. You know, you think about going on a mission trip with Paul. Okay, he strikes a guy blind. John Mark says, done, going home. Okay? And then, you know, then Barnabas says, hey, we need to take John Mark again. Paul said, I ain't taking that whiny kid with me. Well, Paul, you could be a little, no, I'm not hard on him. I'm not taking him. If he goes, I don't go. Well, fine then, you go. Who's the first person he takes on a mission trip after that? Timothy. What does he do with Timothy? Oh, by the way, we got to have you circumcised. Paul's tough to travel with, people. All right? This old man is hard to get along with. I suspect Timothy's going to be a lot nicer kid to be in town with, okay? If Timothy comes, he comes without fear. Now, what does that mean? I mean, he doesn't have to be afraid of you guys. He doesn't have to be afraid of living under my shadow. He doesn't have to be afraid of trying to be me. What you need to understand if Timothy comes is that Timothy's a minister just like I am. Now, what does that mean? That means you treat him just like you would treat me, because we are ministers. Not because he's as good a minister as I am, not because he's got the talents I do, not because he has my background and my skill set, but he has my position, he has my job, he has my goal. And that's it. And by the way, and I may be out of bounds, and I'm, you know, all you have to do is not ask me back, okay? I hadn't heard anybody say anything about what Mike said. I hear an awful lot of traffic about what Mike did. You have 800 people here this morning, not because Mike could speak well, because Mike was a minister. So don't hire some guy that can talk. Hire a minister. Any fool can read an outline. Anybody can talk. Churches don't grow because of what some guy says. Churches grow because of what people learn to do because they're servants. So you're not necessarily looking for a guy who's got a good mouthpiece. It helps, but if he's not a servant, it doesn't matter what he says. Because people don't care how much you know till they know how much you care. And so when you get a guy here, if he comes without fear. He's not going to be compared. He's not going to be held up to a standard that may be a little unrealistic since Mike died and he was in the prime of his ministry. Mike would be a tough act to follow anyway, but under those circumstances, it's going to be very, very difficult to follow. So if Timothy comes, make sure he comes without fear. Why? Because he's a minister, just like I am. And then verse 11, and therefore let no one despise him. It'd be easy to do the compare and contrast between Paul and Timothy. It's going to be very easy to compare between Mike and his family and somebody else and their family. And that's not what it's about. You compare the job they do. They're ministers. What is a minister? A minister is a servant. Everybody in this room is supposed to be a servant. The full-time pulpit minister gets paid to be that servant so he doesn't have to worry about another job somewhere. So he can drop everything he's doing at the minute and go to the hospital or go to a ball game or go to a graduation or go to a birth or go to a birthday party or whatever it is. You just allow him to have the time to do that. But all of you have the same job. And if you get a guy here and he works with you, not for you, he'll be successful as long as he comes to you without fear. Because you recognize that he's a minister just like Mike was, and that no one despise him. Verse 11, therefore let no one despise him, but send him on his journey in peace, that he may come to me. For I'm waiting for him with the brethren. And by the way, the guy that you get won't be here forever. So when you get a guy in, he comes without fear. You give him the recognition that he's going to do the same type job that Mike did. And you don't despise him because he's not Mike. And then if he has to go somewhere else, you send him on his way in peace. Not a bitterness, not any resentment, not any hard feelings. That's what Paul said about this young kid, Timothy. Hey, Timothy's going to come in my vacuum. And when I leave, he's going to come. And you guys don't let him be with fear. And you don't despise him. You give him the same status you'd give me. And by the way, I'm not sure that Corinth needed Timothy as much as Timothy needed Corinth. And it may be that your job, based on what you've learned from your experiences with Mike, is what you need to do to train a minister, how you need to develop a minister. And it may be that you bring in a couple of guys and you train them for a little while and they move on. And it may be that you get to take this wonderful experience you've had with how things are supposed to be and you send them on to be with somebody else that they can be profitable to their work. And I guess the last thing is it doesn't matter how much you love Mike. And it doesn't matter how much Mike loved you. If your relationship with God is not what it ought to be, then you can't do what David did and say, I'm going to go be with him. Hey, folks, you'll sing praises to God with Mike again. You'll fellowship with these people in this room again. But only if you make it your goal that he can't come back to us, but we can go to him. So as we talk about a transition for your church and as we talk about the grieving process and the anniversary of a horrible, horrible loss, all the talk would be in vain if we didn't talk to you about your soul. Because Mike would want you to be with him. Whether it takes you 10 minutes to get there or 10 years to get there, Mike lived, ate, and breathed the idea that I want you to go to heaven with me. Because he never had a doubt he was going. And he wants you to go with him. And if you're here and your relationship with God is not what it ought to be, you need to change that. If you've let this tragedy cause you to withdraw, reinvest. If you've let this tragedy cause you to doubt your strength in God, you know, I heard a saying one time, the guy in a skit's talking to God and he says, I've let you down so many times. And God says, you're never holding me up. Yeah, let God down. You're human. He's not. He understands. Don't withdraw, but draw near to God. If you're here this morning and you're not a New Testament Christian, New Testament Christianity is based on the fact that God said there's a price to pay for sin. I'm willing to let my son pay it on your behalf. And so if you believe that Jesus is the Son of God and He died in your place and He rose from the dead, and you're willing to let that belief affect you to the point you'll change the way you live, we call that repentance. And you'll change the way you live to the point that you will confess Him as Lord, and you'll be willing to die to yourself, be buried and rise again, then you have the hope to rise and be in heaven with Mike and with God and with Jesus and with Paul and with Elijah and Moses and all of us together. Your children this morning studied about Noah, about Jonah. Mike was talking to Jonah this morning. Won't you make the decision to live such a life that we can talk with Mike and Jonah and Abraham and Moses? Scott's going to stand down here when we offer the invitation. You don't need to respond to a stranger. You need to respond to one of your ministers. If you have a spiritual need, if we can pray with you, if we can pray for you, if we can study with you, we can baptize you. Make it your goal to go be in heaven. And don't leave here today with any unfinished business. And come forward as we stand and as we sing.